from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. After nearly a month of rockets, missiles, fighting, another ceasefire effort in Gaza today. Israel saying it's withdrawn its troops. Hamas unleashing one more rocket barrage and saying it's ready to talk. But the toll in death and destruction has been high and profoundly controversial. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon condemned a strike on a UN school in Gaza Sunday as a moral outrage and a criminal act. A gross violation of international humanitarian law, he said. Even the White House saying totally unacceptable, disgraceful. The UN chief has called for accountability. Whose? For what? This hour on Point, Israel, Gaza, the war crimes charge, and the moral debate. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What just happened morally and legally in Gaza? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. A special welcome to our new listeners on KLCC in Eugene, Springfield, Oregon, 89.3 WRKF in Louisiana's capital city, Baton Rouge, WLPR, Lakeshore Public Radio, and Public Media WCSU-FM, Wilberforce, Ohio. Later this hour, we'll be joined by Michael Walzer, political philosopher and professor emeritus at the Institute for Advanced Study, School of Social Science at Princeton, and Lionel McPherson in philosophy, ethics, and social philosophy at Tufts University. Joining me right now from Nashville is Michael Newton, professor of international law at Vanderbilt Law School. Michael Newton, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
So here we are, maybe at the conclusion of a terrible period of destruction and death. More than 1,800 in Gaza, 60-plus in Israel, soldiers and three civilians there. We heard the UN Secretary General with his statement over the weekend saying criminal acts here. Do you see, this is your area of study, and you've been watching along with the rest of the world. Do you see criminal acts in what has just unfolded on one side, both sides? Do you see war crimes in this conflict over Gaza, Professor Newton?
Well, I think it's a very fact-specific question and a very fact-specific inquiry. So the UN Secretary General is making a gross assumption here in the sense that he's simply assuming that the school was intentionally attacked. The press reports I've seen indicate that they were attacking a military target, a fighter on a motorcycle. And so there are other possibilities that might have led to criminality. The dead inside that particular strike came from shrapnel wounds. But the law of war itself is designed to protect civilians. So there's a tiered set of protections designed to protect civilians, and the responsibility is always evenly spread on both parties to do that, exactly that.
How is that matrix of considerations brought to bear? How does it work? I mean, the whole world has seen enormous numbers of civilian casualties. We've all heard the explanation from Israel and the condemnation of Hamas, Israel says, using human shields. And yet we've seen all the children, hundreds of them, women, of course, Hamas fighters in there as well. Explain, how are these distinctions made? After Operation Cast Lead several years ago now, the UN mounted a fact-finding mission. This was led by Justice Richard Goldstone out of South Africa. And their first report came out saying that in that case, they concluded, quoting here, that actions amounting to war crimes and possibly, in some respects, crimes against humanity were committed by the Israel Defense Force. They also said mission found that actions also amount to serious war crimes and possibly crimes against humanity on the side of Hamas. Is this comparable this time? Did something happen? And, of course, later there was a lot of controversy about that, and there was division before that whole story of that mission and report was wrapped up. But are things different this time from Cast Lead?
Well, very different. And just to be clear, the Goldstone report was later rebutted by none other than Justice Goldstone, who said exactly the same thing that I just said a while ago, was that there were very fact-specific inquiries that the Goldstone Commission did not have access to. So, in other words, many of the legal conclusions there were based on inadequate evidence or insufficient disclosure, and there were assumptions made which Justice Goldstone himself later said I reject the findings of that report as being based on biased evidence or incomplete information.
We should say the rest of the panel stuck with it, but he did not, and there was a lot of controversy around that. But yes, it was. Yeah. There were all kinds of later amendments, including on his part. Still, we're looking at the death toll here and the circumstances. Let's take the Sunday incident that the UN chief called a criminal act. And the understanding there, this is in the south of Gaza. The Israeli army said that there were Hamas fighters on a motorcycle. They were trying to get them. There were a lot of people outside a UN refuge there. There were many deaths. How do you come in here as an international jurist and look at those circumstances to decide whether or not the risks that were taken here and the deaths that occurred here in going after apparently the Hamas fighters on a motorcycle were justifiable under the law or not?
Well, the law itself has certain, in the midst of armed conflict, certain non-derogable, non-waivable obligations that are always incumbent. The most core is the principle of distinction, which says that combatants at all times, in all ways, in all circumstances, must distinguish between enemy fighters and civilians and do everything feasible to protect civilians. So the core non-derogable principle at all times is that you can never intentionally attack civilians. That is a per se war crime.
Isn't that a little bit different? It's a little bit different to say do everything possible to avoid harming civilians and never intentionally attack them. Aren't those slightly different things?
Well, they are, absolutely. And that's the point, is that the propaganda assumes that every civilian who is killed has been intentionally attacked on the basis of being a civilian. In the media, those are largely propaganda spins from both sides.
Let's move past propaganda, though I understand it's very large. But you say, do everything feasible to avoid hurting civilians. Let's take the Sunday attack. And I realize you're not on the ground. I realize this would take a lot of close scrutiny to come to a conclusion on. But if you go after a motorcyclist and was it 10, 15 people die and many, many more wounded in their immediate surrounding, how do you decide whether everything feasible was done to avoid that?
Well, there's several other legal obligations. One is the legal obligation to stop an attack if it becomes clear that incidental loss to of civilian life or injury to civilians will be excessive in relation to the damage. So what you're meaning, this is called the proportionality principle.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're assessing is who this particular fighter was, and balancing or weighing the likelihood of civilian damage and loss of incidental innocent life. These things happen very quickly. The second thing that is always required and might have been raised on those facts is that there's always a duty to provide effective advance warning unless circumstances do not permit. The key thing to understand about the law of war is that it is this very fine balance of legal restraint or legal constraint, and yet the warfighter is empowered. So there's broad grant of discretion. So, for example, the effective advance warning requirement, which is a per se requirement, has that caveat, unless circumstances do not permit. So the warfighter is empowered to make those kinds of choices under the law. And then the question is, did they act recklessly? Did what they did in that particular circumstance for each and every strike, was that the functional equivalent of intentionally attacking civilians? Those are very fact-specific inquiries. And that's why it's very important to approach things with a very granular view of exactly what happened, what were the rules of engagement, were they followed, what safety precautions were in place or not followed, what processes were inadequate, what weapon systems were chosen. You know, the law also requires that the weapon system be chosen that is the most discriminate. Because indiscriminate attacks that don't distinguish between fighters and civilians are always prohibited. That's why the rocket strikes, for example, are themselves a war crime.
The Hamas rocket strikes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes, because they're per se indiscriminate attacks using an indiscriminate weapon that doesn't discriminate between civilians and any potential military target.
Here was the U.N. Secretary General. This was even before Sunday. This was last Wednesday after an earlier bombing of a U.N. school. 16 civilians killed, many more injured. Nothing, he said, justifies such horror.
I demand that all parties immediately respect U.N. premises. These are serious violations of international law. The perpetrators of these violations must be held to account.
If someone's to be held to account, or more than someone, who knows, Michael? How would that happen, Michael Newton?
Well, the Israelis have a very sophisticated military justice system, and after the last Gaza incursion, there were more than 200 trials in the Israeli military system, or 200 discrete actions of punishment for violations of rules of engagement, for example, or inappropriate weapons choices, et cetera. But you have to know all the facts. I mean, there were, in fact, documented examples of Hamas rockets stored in schools or of human shields. I've seen Israeli drone footage of one Israeli mortar round that went astray into an empty schoolyard, the very incident that the Secretary General was speaking about last week. The Israeli argument is to say, look, we made one mistake. We hit an empty schoolyard with a mortar round, and then Hamas used for propaganda purposes.
Of course, that assertion...
That's very much in dispute.
Very much contested as well. Michael Newton at Vanderbilt Law School, we're going to forge ahead here. Thank you very much for being with us. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Israel, Gaza, and the war crimes charge. Sounds of chaos there outside the compound of the UN school in Rafah, Gaza, hit in an airstrike on Sunday. For many of those who were there and watching around the world, it was very hard to watch. Civilian death toll very high here. Lots of children in Gaza, lots of children among those civilians. And then the hits on UN installations that were supposed to be places of safety. Here on CBS's Face the Nation, on Sunday, Commissioner General for UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, Pierre Cranboul, condemned Israel for not doing enough, he said, to protect civilians in Gaza after a missile struck just outside another UN school for the second time in a week.
If you look at the extent of the damage, the extent of the physical destruction, but also the extent of the loss of human life, and I witnessed that myself visiting this week the pediatric ward in the main hospital in Gaza, seeing the broken bodies of the children there, there is no doubt in my mind whatsoever that insufficient measures of precaution and control and protection are being taken, including by the Israeli Defense Force, when engaging in Gaza.
Terrible to see. The day before, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made a plea for international support in Israel's fight against Hamas.
I call on all responsible international leaders and decent people everywhere to stand with Israel now. Stand with Israel as it confronts Hamas. Stand with Israel as it defends itself against Hamas' deliberate and indiscriminate attacks on our civilians. Stand with Israel, a democracy fighting a ruthless terrorist organization committed to our destruction.
With me right now from Princeton, New Jersey, is Michael Walzer, political philosopher, professor emeritus at the School of Social Science at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, author of Just and Unjust Wars. Michael Walzer, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. I'm happy to be here.
And with me in the studio today, Lionel McPherson, associate professor of philosophy, ethics, and social philosophy at Tufts University. He's been watching all of this as well. Lionel McPherson, thank you very much for being
here. Thanks for having me on the program.
Michael Walzer, we're looking at a piece you just wrote for The New Republic. Headline, Israel must defeat Hamas, but also must do more to limit civilian deaths. How do you look at legal and moral accountability for what just happened?
First of all, that headline was the New Republic's headline. It doesn't actually reflect the argument of the piece. But,
fair. We'll dig on in.
Beside the point.
Yeah.
The destruction is terrible. I'm a little disturbed that UN officials have already delivered a verdict on Israel's criminality before there's been any inquiry or investigation. That does make it very difficult to imagine a UN inquiry in the future that could possibly be impartial. And so probably there will not be any Israeli cooperation with such an inquiry, since the verdict has already been delivered. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not going to talk about war crimes. I do think that there have been wrongful acts by the Israelis and wrongful use of civilian populations by the by Hamas. How you sort all that out is going to be, as Professor Noonan said, very, very difficult. It's going to require a very close inquiry into particular incidents.
Take us to the philosophical accounting, if you can. You wrote the book on just wars. There are issues here that span law and philosophy of proportionality. When you look at the death toll, and of course it's very high in Gaza, much lower in Israel, thanks to a lot of technology and superior military and the poorer weapons that Hamas had, though they threw just about everything they had out there. Look at this morally. How do you do a moral accounting here, Michael Walzer?
Okay, asymmetric warfare is very, very difficult. And you're right. Israel is the major military power in the Middle East. It's the Goliath of the Middle East. But you have to remember who won the biblical battle.
I believe it was David.
It's very, very hard for a high-tech army to win an asymmetric war, as we lost the asymmetric war in Vietnam, and we're probably losing an asymmetric war in Afghanistan. Israel has not succeeded in winning asymmetric wars in Lebanon or in the previous Gaza incidents. How do you fight a war like that, where the more civilians you kill, the worse it is for you and the better it is for your enemy? Up to a point, because if you really kill a lot of civilians, as the Russians did in Chechnya, or the Sri Lankans when they were fighting the Tamil rebels, no one is looking, and you can kill 100 times what Israel has done in Gaza, then you can win. But Israel can't fight that kind of a war, not morally and not politically. It wouldn't be allowed to fight that kind of a war.
Everybody's watching this time. I mean, it's I've never seen a more heavily covered conflict.
As
we all watch it, then, what do you conclude? Do you conclude that Israel talked about how it would knock on the rooftop with an explosion to tell people to leave? It talked about it leafleted neighborhoods saying go. There's going to be an attack. We heard their ambassador to the United States talking about the Israeli armed forces deserving a Nobel Prize for their restraint. And yet there's that big death toll headed up toward 2,000, more over 1,800.
Yes, that's contested, you know. The Israelis claim that fully half of those people were Hamas combatants.
Well, we concede that among them, hundreds, no doubt, of Hamas fighters, but that leaves hundreds of civilians and children.
Right.
Did you see, in your observation, I know you weren't on the ground, but many of us saw a lot covered here, is sufficient? I mean, and Israel lost a lot of soldiers here, 60 soldiers, 60 plus. That's not a small number.
Right.
Well, was sufficient care taken to avoid the casualties that we've just seen?
I can't make a judgment of that sort. Warnings were given, but warnings are not enough. We all know that. We know that from Vietnam, where we warned civilians to leave. Civilians just don't leave, or not all of them leave, because they've lived there for decades, and all their possessions are there, or because they have sick relatives in the house or aging parents they can't leave. So warnings are not enough.
Or because at a certain point there's nowhere to go. We've seen these streets where block after block are just knocked down.
Right. But again, we don't know. The worst damage has come since the ground invasion, which was precipitated by the tunnels.
Mm-hmm.
And the ground invasion has been costly, both for Israel and for Gazans, because the Israelis are looking for the tunnels, and Hamas knows where the tunnels are. So a number of Israeli units have found themselves in trouble, walked into a trap. And when you're in a trap, and maybe a soldier is wounded, the rules of engagement are relaxed. You can call in an artillery strike that you wouldn't have been permitted to call in until then. And the artillery is not accurate. So once you're on the ground in a crowded environment like that, with tunnels built under houses, you are going to inflict civilian casualties. And I would guess that in some of these instances, the commander on the ground did take all the necessary precautions and maybe minimized the number of casualties, and some other commander panicked and didn't take the necessary precautions and called in an artillery strike when it wasn't necessary. That's what happens in this kind of conflict. An awful lot depends on the skill, the competence, the calmness of the junior officer in the field. And it's very hard for me to sit in Princeton, New Jersey and judge situations like that.
Michael Walzer, stand by. Lytle McPherson, join us. The whole world has been watching, has been very vocal in responding in all kinds of ways to what's happened. The death toll has been very high. We've had an international law jurist say we don't have enough facts to back up Ban Ki-moon's criminal act accusation here. You hear Michael Walzer saying these are indeed fraught moral waters, but you've got the chaos of war in confined space. How do you look in moral terms at what's just happened, Lionel?
Yes, I'd like to direct our attention away from the finer points of the law. To that extent, I would agree with Professor Newton. It's going to be very difficult to make general claims about whether war crimes have been committed because we're not on the ground and we don't have the details that would be necessary to make those kinds of claims, to substantiate those kinds of claims. But on the other hand, I don't think it's very plausible to claim that the fog of war makes it very difficult, nearly impossible, to make any moral judgments about what's going on. We have the numbers, and I think the numbers tell the story. We've got an estimated 1,800 Palestinians killed in Gaza. We've got an estimated 80% of those Palestinians killed in Gaza being civilians. That math breaks
disputed
down.
Disputed figure, but it's high.
Let's say it's a give or take a few hundred. Human lives, that's right. So I've done the math. The math is pretty easy to do. We've got an estimated 5 Palestinian civilians killed for every 1 Palestinian militant. Again, we could adjust that down if somebody thinks that's too high. We could say the number is 3-1. That is 3 Palestinian civilians killed for every 1 Palestinian militant, though the actual numbers right now are estimated at 5-1. We've got 64 Israelis or 64 dead on the Israeli side. Mm-hmm. That is 64 soldiers. We've got 3 civilians killed inside of Israel, 2 Israeli citizens and 1 Thai worker. Mm-hmm. So in short, on one side, we've got roughly 1,500 Palestinians killed in Gaza, and we've got
Civilians, you're saying?
Civilians, mm-hmm. Yes. 1,500 Palestinian civilians killed in Gaza, and we have 3 civilians killed in Israel, 2 Israeli citizens, 1 Thai worker. That sounds extraordinarily unbalanced. If there's any claim about asymmetric warfare, it certainly looks like it's in the other direction. We don't need to make any claim as to whether the Israel Defense Forces are intentionally targeting civilians. I think it's enough to say that they clearly aren't particularly concerned about limiting civilian casualties. Though, of course, it's true that they could do far more damage to civilians if they so desired. But I think the numbers tell the story. That is 500. I've done the math on this. 500 times more Palestinian civilians as compared to Israeli civilians have been killed in the recent violence.
What does that suggest to you in moral terms. It's a terrible ratio. We understand there's a context around it, but it's just a terrible ratio all on its own. If you're thinking proportionality, when you just stare at those numbers, but what does that say? Israel lost more than 60 soldiers. If they felt that there was a absolute need to go in and do something about rockets and tunnels here, what's the moral suggestion of your mathematics? That they should have put their soldiers in more harm's way, potentially lost more soldiers to do the necessary, rather than have that high civilian casualty number?
That's one possibility. The other possibility is a question whether or not there was really such urgency to go into Gaza in the first place, because apparently the rocket attacks and the tunnels have not amounted to any very significant casualties on the Israeli civilian side. Again, there's three civilians killed inside of Israel, two Israeli citizens, one Thai worker. So maybe one could claim that this was preventive for some future point when maybe Hamas rocket attacks might have become so sophisticated that Israelis would have been under great threat. But as it turns out, the Iron Dome air defense system has been a remarkable success. Israel looks like it's largely protected from Hamas rocket attacks. So it's a little bit hard to understand what the extraordinary urgency for Israel to go into Gaza was at this point.
Michael Walzer, I'll bring that to you. First, a caller to Frank in Columbia, South Carolina. Frank, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Your guests have been talking all around it, so I'll be very quick. One of them said earlier, almost categorically, the Hamas rockets, by definition, were indiscriminate and therefore a war crime. I don't see how, when the other side uses some ordinance that has a kill zone of 50 meters, I don't see the difference between that and a rocket.
You find it indiscriminate, what, in its radius of destruction?
When you're firing into an area that has a population density and structures the way Gaza does, I don't know how a 50-meter kill zone can be anything but indiscriminate.
Frank, I appreciate your call. Michael Walzer, we've seen the photographs of unexploded ordnance that hit the ground but did not explode, missiles just about the size of a man from Israel. What about our caller's point morally, Michael?
Well, first of all, I want to respond to the argument that the numbers tell the story. I don't think the numbers tell the story. First of all, one of the reasons for the numbers is that Israel spent a lot of resources not only on the Iron Dome but on shelters for its citizens, and Hamas did not build a single shelter for any of its people, despite the vast amount of construction materials that they invested in the tunnels. And
built a lot of tunnels.
Yes, and a very high tonnage of concrete in those tunnels that could have been used for schools and houses and shelters. But
there were the UN shelters. Israel bombed six of those UN shelters, unless the claim is that there should have been bomb shelters built inside the UN shelters, including schools. I'm not really sure how that point is supposed to be relevant,
Michael,
here, given these facts.
Michael,
I'm telling you, Hamas did not build any shelters. And the UN shelters were not bomb shelters. They were just buildings.
Of course, as the UN said again and again during this conflict, Israel, you know where we are. Please don't bomb us. It didn't quite work out that way. It's a tough situation here. Michael Walzer at Princeton, please stand by, author of Just and Unjust Wars. Lionel McPherson of Tufts University with me in the studio. We're looking at Israel, Gaza, and the war crimes charge, the legal and moral debate over what's just happened. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about Israel, Gaza, and the war crimes charge. We've heard it for days, weeks now, as conflict unfolded around Gaza and beyond. Rockets out, missiles in, tanks and Israeli troops in, though today, ceasefire that as of morning holding there, and Israel saying all of its troops out. We're sort of looking at the moral and legal ledger here. The UN Secretary General has said criminal acts committed here What about it? Lots of the world has looked in dismay at the high death toll. It's an asymmetrical conflict. And nevertheless, as the guns silence a little bit here, we're looking in. Michael Walzer is with us, political philosopher, author of Just and Unjust Wars from Princeton. Lionel McPherson's with me in the studio from Tufts University, associate professor there of philosophy, ethics, and social philosophy. It got pretty fiery out of the White House. Here's White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest saying the administration criticizing Israel for its recent bombings of a UN school in Gaza.
There is a difference in approach between what Hamas is perpetrating on the Israeli people and what Israel is doing to defend their country. But the shelling of a UN facility that is housing innocent civilians who are fleeing violence is totally unacceptable and totally indefensible.
Lots of distinctions attempted to be made during this nearly month-long conflict. Ed in Somerset, Kentucky. Ed, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. My father was in World War II, and we did a lot of carpet bombing where you didn't need to. It was terrible. And then I was in the Army during the Vietnam era, and we did some things there were definitely questionable. But what's going on here is just so different, with Hamas setting up next to churches and schools and public areas just for the sole reason of getting their own people hurt or killed, or they can turn it against Israel. Now, if Mexico was bombing Houston and we had an Iron Dome over Houston, no civilians were killed, what would we do? We would stop it. We wouldn't, you know, we don't want to kill civilians, but this thing against Israel is totally wrong, and I'm really upset about it because they started it and they're setting up in the areas they are for civilians to be killed. It's just sad.
Ed, I appreciate your call. Lionel McPherson. First of all, USA, don't throw stones. You've carpet bombed in the past. Other listeners here are raising, you know, atomic attacks on Japan at the end of World War II and saying this is war. Our caller says it's different because Hamas is deliberately using civilians as cover.
Yeah, I think it's frankly obscene to suggest that the Palestinians, even under Hamas leadership in Gaza, are somehow killing their own people. It's Israel Defense Forces, artillery, missiles that are killing Palestinians in Gaza. That does not mean that there is under no circumstances some use of human shields. But I think, again, if you look at the numbers, it's pretty overwhelming. We have roughly 80% of the Palestinians killed in Gaza are civilians. And ultimately, Israel is responsible for the conduct of its own military forces. Hamas certainly cannot be responsible for the conduct and is not responsible either morally or causally for the conduct of the Israel Defense Forces.
But under international law, both sides have a responsibility to avoid civilian deaths, as I was preparing for this show. Yes, those on offense, in this case, that would, I guess we'd say Israel here, Hamas defense, though I suppose you could even argue those terms. But when you set up near civilians, as I understand it, under international law, you take on a responsibility if those civilians perish.
Yes, you would. I think that's why Israel's bombing of the UN shelters is so unfortunate, and so unfortunate for the defenders of Israel in this case. Many warnings were issued in the case. Actually, the New York Times just reported yesterday in the most recent case, the Jabalia case, Israel, and I'm just reading from the New York Times, August 4th, Israel provided no evidence of such activity, that is, Hamas activity in or around the shelter, and no explanation for the strike beyond saying that Palestinian militants were firing about 200 yards away. That's not my opinion. That is the New York Times writing about the facts, as apparently confirmed by the Israel Defense Forces itself. So, again, there no doubt are cases where Hamas militants are setting up in the vicinity of civilians. And to some extent, Hamas would bear responsibility, some partial responsibility, for those civilian deaths. But it's clear that in many other cases, that's not the case. And again, that's why I think the bombing of the UN shelters has been such a disaster morally and also in terms of public relations for Israel.
Michael Walzer, come back to the UN shelters. The UN distraught about the repeated instances of attack and death on their shelters. And come back once again, if you would, since Lionel does, to the raw numbers here, both, if you would, Michael.
Yeah, I think you have to ask the cui bono question, which I think liberals and leftists especially are taught always to ask, who benefits? Israel does not benefit from hitting UN sites. Israel does not benefit from killing civilians. These are disasters for the people of Gaza, but they are also disasters for the state of Israel. And if even if you have no faith in the moral conduct of the IDF, you have to have some belief in its rationality. They cannot intend to be killing this number of civilians.
Is it absolutely clear that there's no benefit here? I mean, over time, many countries have used violence to try to push civilians away from armed actors, have used violence to cow.
Right, right. If that was Israel's policy, it would have to kill a lot more civilians than it is killing, which it certainly could do. And that might be a deterrence, and they could win the kind of victory that the Russians won in Chechnya, except that they can't, as we all know, both because it's not IDF policy to win wars like that, and also because Israel would never be allowed to win a war like that. So given that they can't kill civilians in sufficient numbers to produce that kind of victory, it's obvious, it seems to me, I think Lionel has agreed with this, that this is a disaster for Israel. He calls it a PR disaster. Okay, but PR means an awful lot in asymmetric warfare.
What about the bombing of the refuges here, the UN facilities? We've seen the UN say that they called their GPS coordinates in 30-plus times for particular camps to Israel.
And
Israel
some artillery commander didn't get the message. Yes, and that was certainly wrong. He, whoever ordered that artillery strike, should not have done so. But that's one person in the field who, for whatever reason, ordered artillery to fire, not at the UN facility, but too close to it. And artillery is not precise. So, yes, that happened. But that cannot have been, as the UN, various UN spokesmen have pretty much asserted, that cannot have been an intentional act, given the harm it does to Israel.
Possibly, though we're regaled with stories of the sophistication of the Israeli military at the same time, it's difficult territory. Mike in Ladysmith, Wisconsin. Mike, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
It's the calculus that's missing here is where is the weighting factor given to who started this particular shooting event? Now, when you have thousands of rockets being launched at the State of Israel, how is that not going to, in some way, weight this ethical dilemma that has been generated? Had they not started shelling, or rocket fire, I guess is the right word, this wouldn't have started in the first place. And then secondarily, your last guest just made probably the best point through here, is that, you know, there's a reason why the phrase fog of war has come into the lexicon of modern warfare. The fog of war right now is... It needs to be taken into account when you have a small team of soldiers trapped in an area, and they call for a supporting artillery fire. They're not vetting that up through the national government, and where some phone call may have been made hours before or weeks before.
Surely the U.S. has laid down a lot of fire over time to support its own troops. It's hard to throw stones here, and yet... here this is in front of the whole world, fog of war, yes, but on the other hand, Mike, it's interesting, when we've seen more of this than I can recall for a long time seeing, and it's troubling to look at. The question of who started it, Michael Walzer, is that key here? Do we have to go back to sort of, you know, first tit and tat? That's a long history in this case, and when you do that, you, in your piece in The New Republic, you don't just look at Hamas rockets, you also look at what you say, you know, Israeli settlements and the seizure of Palestinian land and water, the failure, as you portray it, to deal with the settler movements, zealots and thugs. That you go for who started it. There's a lot to look at, Michael.
Right, right. And there are two different levels of of looking. First, I think the right wing, the recent right wing governments of Israel bear a considerable responsibility for the ongoing conflict, because they have not met the challenge and defeated the settler movement and set up the negotiation and pursued negotiations with the Palestine Authority that could lead to withdrawal and statehood and sovereignty for the PA. And had an Israeli government done that, we don't know what the response of Hamas would have been. Hamas doesn't object to the occupation of 67. It objects to what it calls the occupation of 48. All Israel is occupied territory in the eyes of Hamas. So it's not clear that an Israeli agreement with the PA to set up a Palestinian state alongside Israel would be accepted by Hamas, but still, certainly, it would have made it much, much more difficult for Hamas to fight the kind of war it has chosen to fight. Mm. That's one level. And then the other level is the siege of Gaza by Israel and Egypt, and remember, with the tacit support of the Palestine Authority, is that siege a legitimate reason for launching Hamas's attack? And there I think the blame doesn't fall on the Israel-Egypt siege, which, if you look at the tunnels and the rockets, it hasn't been all that successful. But that was not a sufficient reason for the Hamas rocket attacks. So in that sense, if the Israel bears, I think, some blame for the ongoing conflict, considerable blame. But for this particular war, I think Hamas is the root cause of the war.
We've seen lots of dispute over just that issue. Stan in Southwick, Maine. Stan, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. Stan from
Massachusetts. Excuse me, yes.
Yeah, that's okay. I think the underlying issue, it could be resolved very easy, is if Israel would just let the Palestinians have freedom. We're talking about wars and casualties. I mean, let them fish outside that 3 kilometers. Let them travel. Let them get things that, I mean, they're basically trapped in an outdoor cage, and anybody and everybody is going to react the way they are. I'm not standing up for what they're doing, but I think the resolution would be very easy on Israel's part. Let them live like human beings.
And to the Hamas charter that says no Israel? What about it, Stan?
Oh, no, absolutely not. But let the Palestinians have freedom to travel, to bring goods in. I mean, look at that, what they did with that boat. They were trying to bring humanitarian aid in, and the Israelis...
Yeah, I mean, Israelis might say, well, we made a stab at that. It didn't work out so well after we withdrew from Gaza. But point taken, Stan. Go the other way, not the military way, but go the open way. Greg in Marlow, New Hampshire. Greg, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay.
My point's a lot similar to the last caller. I feel like the Palestinians, people, they're getting the brunt of it and the short end of the stick. You know, we would all react the same exact way, and it's kind of hard to believe that the Israeli military doesn't know where they're firing or what they're firing at, and it doesn't seem like it's one isolated instance of one UN building being shot at, or, you know, people being hurt inside a UN building. It's multiple instances. So it's kind of hard to believe that they don't know exactly where they're shooting and what they're firing at. Israel's agenda is very clear, and it surprises me that there's even a question about that.
Greg, I appreciate your call. Lionel McPherson, does the world just roll on here? You know, Michael says, well, if the UN is talking this way before we've even had an inquiry, how are they going to be an effective agency to look into this? Do we just sort of, you know, put another notch in the belt of international conflict and move on? Is that it?
There won't be any moving on, I think, both for the reasons that the previous two callers alluded to and that Michael Walser himself did, which is the occupation is going to continue, it looks like. There is no resolution to that in sight, and that is the underlying political reality which is fueling this kind of violence. So this is yet another cycle. It looks like perhaps the most brutal and lopsided cycle of violence. So as far as Israel's security is concerned, they have a lot to be optimistic about. Only three Israeli civilians have died, or actually two Israeli civilians and one Thai worker inside of Israel. But the political resolution looks like it's no closer than it's been. So the question I think going forward, and again, I'm inclined to agree with Michael Walser on this, is how is this going to play out in terms of public relations, setting aside the legal issues and the moral issues? How is Israel going to proceed with an occupation given the overwhelming power and security that it now enjoys as compared to the Palestinians?
Michael Walser, does the moral calculus change on the back of these numbers and the events of the last month?
I wouldn't put so much stress on the three Israeli casualties. You've had millions of Israelis running to shelters. And you have Israeli parents afraid to send their kids to school, and you have nobody willing to go to any crowded area. No state is going to tolerate that condition for its citizens. Admittedly, much better than what's going on in Gaza.
Well, the whole world has watched it. We'll see what the world's judgment is and whether it matters. Michael Walser at Princeton, Lionel McPherson at Tufts University, thank you very much for joining us. This is On Point.